Let's just real quickly before we get started on a nice topic, make sure that we are accumulating something here. So I just want to go back to the first night we were talking about freedom, and can we go around and maybe is there two or three things that people remember now this many weeks later about what we talked about then that they're still either using or is what we would carry into today, something that we could carry into today from that first. So what are people that were here in the first evening take away from the question of freedom? How would we characterize a sense of freedom?
Was it something to do with responsibility?
So one element was responsibility, right? So you can't have, so the, one of the first principles we talked about was completely against the modern world. You can't have freedom without taking absolute responsibility. So as we talked about the first night, everyone's looking for a way to find something else to be that's responsible for what's happening. But any place that you give away responsibility, you also give away that amount of freedom, right? We're clear about that because wherever that is would have to be the space that you're giving away where it is that you could have freedom from. So we're pretty clear on that responsibility. Is there another aspect of
Not being on this way of habituation.
so freedom from habituation? So we talked a lot about which we'll get into tonight too, is the problem of how much freedom can we have from habituation. We talked about a lot of different kinds of habituation. Does anybody see a way they need to practice or a way they need to approach practice, life, experience, or something that would lead towards greater freedom in the sense that we were talking about it the first evening?
I think you mentioned solitude or being okay
Yeah.
with
So
solitude.
did people come away with I would hope people came away with the importance of developing the space that we would call solitude, because the greatest amount of freedom is the greatest amount of comfort you have in your own solitude, right? And if you're extremely confident and comfortable in your solitude, from that space, which is sort of infinite, I mean, that space of solitude is where emptiness, a deeper sense of emptiness, a deeper sense of silence, a deeper sense of listening, all the elements that would require you to not be taken up with something in the mind. All have something to do, at least at the beginning stage. We're only talking about the beginning stage, with a sense of really developing your sense of solitude. Would everybody? So that whenever you have an extra moment from your responsibilities and from the way to use that time almost completely against our current modern construct again, is to use that time for solitude versus more activity, but as soon as you start working on that solitude, you'll find, many people find barriers, like boredom is a barrier. A feeling of missing something is a barrier. There's psychological barriers to a sense of absolute confidence in solitude that you have to work your way through. You just have to know that there'll be a gate that you'll have to work through to get comfortable in that sense of solitude. So those are three: responsibility, solitude, habituation. Is there anything else that people took away?
Sense of infinite possibilities.
Okay, the sense of freedom is
Conscious awareness
an infinite set of possibilities
unlimited.
that are unlimited. And so the irony of existence is And in a way, you could almost define emptiness. There's a way of looking at emptiness that's the realization of the state of infinite possibilities, and that each time you choose to pick up something in your mind, that the infinite possibilities are collapsed into the single thought, or tonight, the upset, how we move to obsession, okay? So that's a good one for tonight, because how do we move from infinite freedom to obsession? That's something that we really have to watch closely our minds, because at every given moment we have an infinite set of freedom and an infinite set of possibilities. And then how do those collapse into a particular focus or a particular object of desire or a particular, so that's another good one. I don't know if there's that's we could probably, if anyone's got one more, we could. Those are four really good ones.
We talked about how this generation has more freedom than any other generation in history, yet because of all of the busyness and the noise and the lack of conscious awareness is not fully utilizing this freedom.
Right, and then we did talk a little bit about this generation. At least my perception is it has a tremendous amount of potential freedom, and hopefully what we'll be able to do over time is bring some of the issues that we're talking about now into a context where this generation can better understand them within the context of their freedom. And yet that freedom, as you say, the freedom doesn't seem to have been fully realized psychologically, in the sense that people actually feel that kind of freedom. They seem to feel fairly distracted, fairly anxious, quite a bit of fear, so forth and so on and so forth. And a lot of the activities are not activities of freedom, they're activities of compulsion or activities of. So, I mean, we won't do too much, we don't need to go back into that, but it's an interesting phenomenon related to the question of freedom. And a kind of irony, but yet not an irony, because the freedom's still there. It's not ironic, because the freedom is actually still, I think, very much potentially there. But I would just make a claim that the problem, if you have a problem with current generation, it isn't free enough. I know everybody else would think that what you really want to say is that it should be less free, because it's like, all these bad mouthings of it with narcissistic and self-referencing, all those guys. I don't know what all those things are. I don't know what those don't sound that negative in any sense. I would just say that the question is whether people have really realized the potential of freedom. Maybe they need to get a lot more free. So we could look into that. We won't do that tonight, probably, but okay, the second night we talked about happiness. So the third night we talked about happiness. So what do we take away from happiness? We had liberty in the pursuit of happiness.
It's a great happy, happy, joy, joy.
We
That's what I
did.
remember.
Missed that movie. Anyway.
We talked about the interconnectedness between happiness and the concept of freedom, and how the freedom that most people want is the freedom to be left alone.
Okay. So yeah, we talked about
In America.
in,
In
in, in
America.
America, that the a lot of people don't understand about America is that one of the primary impulses of what people mean by freedom is the freedom to be left alone, which is a very conservative, which explains conservatism quite well. If you don't understand that issue, I think it's very hard for people to understand the kind of conservatism they find in America. Because being left alone is not having other people's power over you. And we got into a whole lot of thing about power and freedom and the relationship between power and freedom.
So if you have needs and you put power in something outside of yourself, the power in yourself would be not having any needs.
Right.
So
So the
how
first thing
do
about happiness was anytime we're in a situation, anytime we're in a kind of neediness, and then the happiness is getting the need met, that's exactly the opposite of what we're meaning by happiness. So what most people mean by happiness is having a need that then gets met. But as we pointed out from a Buddhist perspective, that's always going to be transitory. There's no way that that's going to work in the long run, because each time a need's met, it's only met within the conditions of that situation, and those conditions will always change. Your internal process will change, the external context will change. And so that kind of happiness, we wanted to differentiate what most people mean by happiness and the kind of happiness that we were pointing to a couple weeks ago, which was a happiness that was this fundamental contentment that, to some degree, that solitude, the first week, having a sense of incredible contentment in your own solitude, and a kind of listening carefully to other people so that you actually experience other people rather than kind of territorializing with your projections and so forth. Or just, you're always ever, you're not actually relating, you're more projecting on them your own stuff. So even in terms of relationship, you need a sense of both happiness and freedom so that you could even like listen. And that, and a sense of caring would require a deep sense of solitude, so it wasn't out of a need or a desire or a projection or something. So we spent a lot of time on relationship, happiness. Again, happiness for a lot of people, it has to do with relationship. But again, we were talking about how that if the happiness is in the deep sense of your own contentedness, then you can share that, rather than the relationship being a projection of need, which, as most people have experienced, have tried that out, it works for a little while, but it has various kinds of, problems as time goes on. So we talked about it. So with those things in hand, sort of, a sort of sense what we've been talking about so far, let's go into today, tonight's thing then a little bit, which is obsession. So let's first of all kind of define what obsession is versus emotion or thought. Okay, so emotion is not obsession. So are we we're real clear that you can have an emotion and that's not an obsession. In fact, an emotion is in an interpretation of a present experience based on past experience. Emotion is as you attend to the present moment, based on experiences you've had in the past, you then experience the present moment within a certain context, and that context is often the emotional context of it. So it starts with liking or disliking it based on past habitual experience, and then I like it a little bit, then I have some, and then there's a whole set of emotions that might arise that apply to that experience. But if you look at all those emotions, those are all, and there's a lot to learn from emotions. Emotions are kind of very honest. Emotions are sort of the honest way we actually are in the present. Now, we're not actually in the present, we're in the past. It's sort of the honest way we're in the past, in the present. An emotion is sort of the honest way we are in the present, in the past. Are we there? You see it? I mean, first of all, you see how emotions take today or take the last week. What were emotions? The emotions were the present, but the past coming into the present by association, usually. By various associations that you have. But then you have this repertoire of emotions which you're carrying with you that are a little bit akin to another repertoire of things called thoughts. So yeah, you also have a repertoire of thoughts that you're carrying with you. The repertory of thoughts are represent, but in abstraction. Thoughts are the past and the present in abstraction. Not, you're not actually experiencing the present, you're in the abstraction of the present, but you're actually in a thought. You're actually in the past, in the present, in an abstraction. Is okay, stop for just a second. Are we good so far?
Might want to run that over
What's
again.
abstraction?
Abstractions are meaning that thoughts are representations of past experiences as now remembered.
It could also be for the perceived future.
There isn't anything that can be perceived in the future that wasn't in the past as a thought. It can only be a projection. All thought as thoughts are all past experiences as representations as projected. That's not the only way you can experience the future or the present. That's not, you could experience the present and the future and the present in other ways than through thoughts and emotions. But if you're experiencing them through thoughts and emotions, they're the past and the present as projected. One's very abstract, the other one's very, you can actually feel emotions physically. They're actually oftentimes much more vibrating in the body than a thought is, although a thought can be very powerful too. Okay, so are we clear about thoughts? I mean, that was a lot, but is everybody, can we move on from, and now you can look at your day of emotions and kind of go back into them a little bit and see how they were operating. They also operate in patterns, so they're not individual. They're oftentimes thoughts and emotions don't happen like with an individual emotion or individual thought. They're usually complexes of thoughts and complexes of emotions that are interconnected too by association. So emotions are interconnected by it. So you can have 7, 8, 9, 10 emotions around one experience. And as you add the number of emotions, the situation becomes more ambiguous, more, what would you call it, sublime in the positive or negative sense of it, you know? The more bittersweet, the more complicated, you know. So are we good so far? So do you ever operate in something other than thoughts or emotions? And so are you ever not in the past, in the present, or?
Doesn't that emotion also associate with the future projection? Like, well, yesterday, last night, my father was in ER, and I sat in the living room and I talked to my sister through the computer, and I began to image or picture or develop the story of maybe dad won't pass this time, and I have to pack my suit and I go back to Taiwan, and I began to develop this future story. And those stories deeply impact my emotions. So,
well, as it's funny, tomorrow we're going to do, in another class tomorrow, we're doing Heidegger. So if there was anybody, you know, that talked about this issue in a very interesting way, it was Heidegger talking about we're always ahead of ourselves and our possibilities as we're projecting our head ourselves in time, and so we're actually constructing temporality in our kind of projections ahead. And so it is true that we're projecting ahead of ourselves, but as we all know, the projection of ahead of ourselves is the not yet here-ness of time. It's not it, and all that we know about it is our projections from the present and the past. Truly, we project into it in our narrative, but aren't we always just projecting what we know? Aren't we just projecting what we fear or we know or we think or we feel? We're projecting it sort of ahead, and it would take, one of the things that you'd have to say about cultivation is trying to open up the future from its stuck past. I mean, that's one way you could talk about cultivation. One way we could say that cultivation is that if you're really meditating and cultivating, you're trying to open up the future from the stuck past of the stuck past of the habituation that you're projecting into it. Is that? Because as long as you're projecting into the future your experiences that you've already had, then you can see you're extremely limited in both the present and the future in terms of what you're bringing about in the future. You're sort of bringing about your future totally based on the past. And isn't that the problem of karma? if you really want to talk about the problem of karma, isn't the problem of karma that it traps the free present and an infinite set of possibilities of the future into the karmic conditions of the past? And insofar as you're projecting those as your future, you live the future you project. Are we good so far? So, of course, from a Buddha, from the point of view of sitting or Buddhist practice of like stillness or emptiness, if you looked at emptiness, you could see that emptiness, there's another one way to look at emptiness is this the conscious awareness stilling itself so it's in the infinite present. Okay, if we're talking about temporality, it's stilling, the conscious awareness is stilling itself in the infinite present. So it's stilling itself in the infinite present, and also not only in the infinite present, but also the conscious awareness contains the infinite space. So the conscious awareness is in infinite space in the infinite present, right? Isn't that sitting? I mean, when you're, I'm not saying we sit like that all the time. As a kind of practice, we're trying to take that kind of time and space into the present, sort of. So far, we're good so far on emotions, thoughts. Then we have like patterns of thoughts. We have the pattern of thought that most of you live with all the time is your sort of narrative story, right? We'll just call it your narrative story, your self that you think you are, that you've like created somewhere back when you were young, and then you got more invested in it, and then you got more invested in it, and then by now most of you are pretty imbued in your storyline. So it's an internal voice that's constantly talking to yourself and telling and narrating your existence. It's like you're a novel that's sort of in the process of happening. And as a novel, you're sort of writing itself as it goes, but it's a narrative story about what's going on. And in fact, in the narration of it, you almost like always miss the present moment in the interpretation of it. The narrative story is another way in which it's a way to seeming to be in control of something that's not controllable. I mean, conscious awareness and the flow of consciousness is ultimately not under control in a certain kind of way, but the narrative story gives us the illusion of control by interpreting everything through the storyline. Everybody knows their narrative. Everybody's pretty familiar with their narrative voice talking. And some of you have functional narrative voices, and some of you have dysfunctional narrative voices. So, and how would we even determine that they're functional or dysfunctional? Well, we could use our two criteria. Are you contented in your solitude, and are you fundamentally contented and happy? Why don't we just use the criteria that we've started so far? I'm just, it's a little bit arbitrary, but since those are two markers we have, how's it going? How's the narrative story going in terms of delivering on existence? We could have everyone give a report on how their narrative story is,
Progress report.
how it's going. What's that?
Progress report.
Yeah, we could have a progress report on people's narrative construct. And then we talked a little bit about narratives constructs in terms of different criteria, particularly the internal sense of it versus the external sense of its success within a social construct. So one marker of it would have to be within the world that we live in right now and that we exist in right now, how are you doing, not only in your own process of your own experience, but in the larger world in which you exist or interact with, or at least you project into? How's it going? So as we move to the question, I say all these things ahead because for sure we want to understand that when we're talking about obsession, we're not talking about thoughts or emotions. Emotions are not something that we're afraid of. In fact, the key thing about emotions is that we're not afraid of them. That we're willing to. I think the key thing about emotions is that we're willing to watch them arise. See them arise. Not be afraid of them, but not be moved by them. So emotions arise, and we see them arise, and we just, when we have sort of a solidity from which this kind of contented solidity, or wherever we want to see that we have this solidity from, the emotion can arise. It passes through. It says something about where we're at a little bit, and then it passes through. We're not afraid of it. The trick with emotions is that we're not afraid of them when they arise, but we're not attached to them to want more out of them. As an emotion arises, if you go towards it and want more out of the emotion or fear the emotion, then it gives that emotion more power. So either fear, but remember, it's not fear or desire of what the emotion's about. It's fear or about the actual emotion itself. Be careful because you'll mistake what you're looking at to be the thing that the emotion's about, and that's not where the information is. Is everybody, from a cultivating view, it's not, don't mistake the emotion for what you think the emotion's about. Because if you mistake it for what it's about, you'll miss what's actually happening with the emotion in terms of what it's actually about, which is something that's arising now in you that must have some reason for emerging because it's in a flow of something. And so you can work with every emotion that arises for it to lose its power, either towards something or fearing, by simply not reacting to it, by either attaching to it or want what it's about, or on the other hand, fearing it and trying to repress it. Repressing emotions does not work. Repressing emotions is an emergency procedure. It's like in an emergency, you repress. And there may be many emergencies. Okay, I'm not saying that you guys all don't have emergencies. But remember, when you're repressing an emotion, that you're taking an emergency action because you're not able to deal with it in a contented, fresh, spontaneous mind, and therefore you're going to need to get back to it. You may need to pass on it right now because you're not can't take it, which I completely understand. But never, in every emotion, never think that you, by avoiding it, that you've done anything or gotten rid of it or solved it. You've simply put it off. And it still needs to stay at a level of consciousness and not think that something's been resolved by just simply passing it by. Is
Good
everybody,
example.
we are going somewhere here. It may not appear to that way, but towards obsession here. Does everybody see it's and the same things with thoughts. Now, thoughts aren't as powerful, so it's very easy. Oftentimes, thoughts are very easy to pass by. In fact, in terms of thoughts, all you have to do is get a little sleepy and thoughts disappear, if you notice. All you have to do is get slightly distracted and most of your thinking apparatus disintegrates immediately. So it's fairly easy to get rid of the process of thinking. It's not so easy to get rid of the process of emotions. So far so good. Does anybody have any questions or comments before we now kind of move on? We're just sort of kind of ground, we're kind of setting a groundwork here. Anybody? Just keep going. So to take a first stab at what the difference between obsession and what we've been talking about so far, to take a first stab at it, we really have to go back to our first evening, and we have to make a distinction that at least at the level of human existence right now, as a we don't want to put too much to this. This is a kind of metaphor and a marker. But as a metaphor, what we want to do is have the greatest amount of freedom of mind, so that in that greatest amount of freedom of mind, we have the greatest amount of flexibility of mind. And the greatest amount of freedom of mind, the greatest amount of flexibility with the least amount of habituation operating in it, that will feel very content. There'll be words that we could put to that. There'll be a certain amount of contentment to that state. There'll be a certain amount of fundamental happiness to that state. There'll be some other things that go with that. If we take that as a frame of reference to start with, then whatever's taking that up and how much is taking that up is working against our nature, is losing the freedom, contentment, and solidity of our nature, our fundamental nature. This is just human existence. What I've just described is just human existence. This is not the Buddha. Where we're confused is we've gotten so confused that a moment of being human feels like you got enlightened. Okay, let's not confuse a moment of being human with being enlightened. A moment of being human is just a moment of being human, but hardly anyone's ever experienced it. Is everybody clear? In a moment of being human is simply what I've just described. That's just called human nature. What I just described, human nature. Completely complete without lacking, completely contented, completely quiet, still, completely contented in solitude, completely listening to what's going on, completely confident in their nature, and so forth and so on. This is just human nature. This is just somehow we've given that up. And so the nature that we're talking about, insofar as we're developing or cultivating that nature, when we start talking about transcendental stuff, when we start talking about the Buddhas and stuff like that, you have to get back to that place before the gate even opens up. Is everybody coming? You have to get back to human nature, being still, solid, whatever, before the potential opens up to enter in entirely different realms and realms of existence than the current one that you're in purely from habituation. Everybody in this room is completely in the reality construct they're in from their own habituation. Nothing else is keeping you in that other than your own habituation. So you have to be motivated, like, okay, I'd like to maybe enter into some other realm than the one I'm in. And if you look around and try to follow everything through, it's all pretty, I mean, if I started describing the current reality construct, you could probably see why it would be better to maybe see if there's an alternative, but I'll leave it to you to make that decision. But as everybody sees so far, so what is obsession then? We'll take a first shot. Is obsession is when an object of desire, a set of emotions, a set of thought, whatever, however we've been, these takes over the conscious awareness to a degree that the conscious awareness doesn't have the space to operate and observe from. The more the conscious awareness is taken up with something that the conscious awareness doesn't have the place to observe, be mindful, you know, kind of, even if it's unstable, but it's still, the more that it's taken up by whatever, the more obsessive. We're going to use obsession for what that is when the conscious awareness is taken up. So when it reaches a point of extreme obsession, There's no place for the conscious awareness to even see what's going on, to even see that it's obsessed. Why we want to be careful about anything leading to obsession is the further into obsession somebody gets, the less they're able to have any place they can observe, analyze, understand, and so forth, what's going on in their process of conscious awareness that then they could even use to look at anything from, whether it be causality, their own experience, other people's experience. There's no place to look at anything because your mind has been taken over. Now, a lot of people have experienced this in love. Probably the most common place that people have experienced this in that is in romantic love. You know, so romantic love doesn't have to be obsessive. I'm not making a correlation. I'm using it as an analogy because it's probably the one thing that most people have had some experience of. You know, there's all kinds of relationships, and we're not now talking about all relationships. However, romantic love is probably the example of obsessive thought that the most people have probably had. And anybody who's had that experience knows how it takes over the conscious awareness. So does everybody see by that analogy what we're talking about here? Something that takes over the conscious awareness so there's no space to observe from.
Could you describe how that happens?
We'll get to that, how that happens. But does everybody know what we're talking about before we know how it happens? It can happen about objects of desire. It can happen people. It can happen fame. It can happen about fame, wealth.
The feeling.
This obsessiveness can be about many different things. It doesn't have to be about love or a person. It can be about... Obsession can happen around wealth. Obsession can happen about fame. Obsession can happen about being stuck in past habits. The way psychoanalysis talks about it is having experiences in childhood or somewhere in our experiences that we lock into an interpretation of that experience that locks in the conscious awareness to then interpret everything through that habitual experience. Is it? But which is the same thing as saying you're in love, you see everything through the same habitual experience. So, you know, whether it's childhood experience that's locked in and the conscious awareness is taken over by that way of looking at things, or through something you've chosen even now to get all in, you know, excited about and involved in. Now, earlier in childhood, if we go to psychoanalytic kind of views or psychological different kind of, you know, Jungian or Freudian or Lacanian views, Lacanian is seeing things based on a lacking. I'm not going to go through the whole structure of it because that'll take us way off tonight. But Lacan, the reason that Lacan became such a big figure in critical postmodernism is because rather than seeing the basic driving force as sexual desire or eros as Freud did, he saw that the fundamental problem was not desire, unmet desire or repressed desire. He saw that Lacan saw the major problem was early childhood experiences of lacking, a sense of lacking that was more socially constructed rather than biologically determined, okay? And why was that important socially? Because then that opened up the whole critical, cultural, historical relativism thing versus the biological. I'm not going there tonight. I'm sorry for that one. But for those of you who have any familiarity with what I'm talking about, just real quick. So Lacan opened up the space of kind of a social construct of the psyche. And in that social construct, what are we searching after on trial lives? We're searching after repeating an experience of being cared for that never actually existed. That's a great joke there, okay? So we're endlessly searching after, we projected in early childhood to be the center of all attention that our early childhood never actually had for us, but we projected that we had. And then we spend our whole lives going after trying to be loved, cared for with a certain sense of lacking. So we're constantly after appreciation. Couldn't you all see that your every action's been based upon a need for appreciation? And the joke was the trying to get back to an appreciation that was never there to begin with. Not funny, but. And no one ever can appreciate that way because they're in their own construct of a lack of appreciation. And so you're endlessly looking for someone to appreciate you in a way that it's in that you're looking for something that never existed and never would exist. And you're relentlessly going after that in every possible way, and everything's just a projection of that. Versus the Freudian way that would see it more as a series of erotic desires and so forth that we're searching after, and the repression of those erotic desires then create a constant energetic force that we're then trying to get through fetish, through finding objects to cathex on, to get off on, so to speak, as we are constantly trying to find objects to relieve our erotic desire on, we go through a transference. And so now the whole of capitalism is this massive transference of sexual desire on the whole of capitalism. And we're buying all this stuff and doing all this stuff and in all these transactions and virtual transactions, all projected out of a fundamental desire that was repressed by necessity in early childhood, because we're in a social construct and not a narcissistic self-referencing, and so that social construct had to repress our narcissism early on, and now we're in a constant process of narcissistic projections on objects of desire. That's the entire of capitalism, right? That we're all caught up in. And of course, the Jungian view is taken a little bit differently, because the Jungian view is seeing that the fundamental issues are archetypes of the unconscious, the archetypes of the unconscious. So we're in the archetypes of the unconscious. What we're driven by is these balances of elements of the unconscious, that if we realize those archetypes, we're happy and contented. Insofar as we don't realize those archetypes of the unconscious, we're endlessly out of balance or projecting out around these archetypes to have objects of desire that actually connect with the archetypes that we're existing in. So the driving force from all of these are either a fundamental lacking or a fundamental desire that's being repressed. That's the driving force of our personality at all times in a sort of unconscious or hidden way. We can't see on the surface the push and pull of that unconscious force. And in those contexts, obsessions are those elements that take over, either from early childhood or forever, that take over our conscious awareness in ways that are unconscious to us and take over our kind of psychological space, or our kind of psychic space, sort of take over the freedom of our psychic space. But according to all those views, the most of what's happening is on an unconscious level, not on a conscious level. So it puts the power of where we find the answer to what's going on into the unconscious, and takes it away. They all, to some degree, take away the place where consciousness, where we have a responsibility in consciousness, in our consciousness. So obsession then is, in a beginning, look, so then how does that happen? How do we get to obsession? That's our next question. Are we all have a sense of what obsession is? What obsessive thoughts, what powerful thoughts that obsession is, either in ourselves or other people?
I think, are you making a differentiation between kind of what might be like a temporary obsession, like I'm really obsessed with getting into the best college, or I'm really obsessed with like, this romantic partner, versus sort of the other thing I heard you touching upon, which was like more of like an elemental, like the basis of our unconscious is a kind of obsession with
Right. And not only that, I would make a differentiation even in the first case of what you're saying, that being obsessed and getting in the right college is only temporary. You know, in other words, you know, you get in or you don't get in, and while you're in the process of being focused on that, you don't or do, and then you move on. So you could say there's temporary obsession. But it's not, but there's still the space of the conscious awareness in that example that you just gave. The conscious, to the degree that the conscious awareness is still operating, getting in or don't getting in, you can take to various degrees of emotional, with, you know, with a sense of humor or a sense of, to the degree that there's not a sense of conscious awareness operating on a larger level, then there's less of an ability to deal with the focus that you bring to it, even in the short term. So there's a mechanism to this. It's the same mechanism in all for all obsessions, really. It's how much it takes over the conscious awareness and how much space there is of conscious awareness to react to whatever it's about.
As you say that, it kind of feels like it connects back to how you're describing what emotions are.
Right.
Because then when you don't get in, then you feel maybe like a sense of lack. And
right.
That becomes how you interpret other emotional situations.
Exactly. But now we're getting down a road. Very good, because we're going to start getting into how this works. That was a really good example. So getting in the school, do you see how the example you gave was really, really good? Because getting in the school, not getting in school, doesn't actually feed into a lacking that becomes very obsessive unless the sense of lacking is already in the storyline that this reinforces. In other words, any individual experience that we're having, whether we gain or lose, or the worst thing happens to us, actually doesn't actually matter. It kind of comes and goes. However, to the degree that it's become obsessive, in my definition of taking over the conscious awareness, where something else could happen, a new interpretation could arise, is taken over. Because to the degree that it's taken over by this we're constant, then there's no conscious awareness space to take a new tack or go in a different direction or have another interpretation or... What was a total freedom, an absolute possible total freedom of reacting to this person dumping you or not getting into school, where you actually had the, you could have taken that in a million, you could even looked at them both as opportunities to an extreme, but you could take it all the way through all kinds of other, you didn't have the space to do that in. And the degree you don't have the space to do it, we're calling that obsessive. So it's in a gradation. There's no like, obsession, it's a gradation. It's a gradation, and it's a gradation that I would suggest you have to be really, really, really look out for in your head. This, as you move down the road of obsession about anything, you're losing the freedom of your conscious awareness that you're able to. So it's something you have in your mindfulness, it's one of the first places you need to really be aware of. To not, as the gradation of obsession begins to arise, you're losing the foundation of how you're going to be able to deal with it. It no matter what it is. And there's a gradation. And a lot of what we're doing is not about obsession. I just want to make sure we're not, but you know, but I think everybody here knows what I'm talking about, what the difference is, without me trying to get too in their own process. Because this is only something that I want you to look at in your own process, not as a clinical definition of something. We're not looking at a clinical psychological definition here. What we're trying to do is use it in a cultivating way to look at your own process. And where do you see those kind of things arising that we would call more like this? I would say are very dangerous to a cultivator, or are very dangerous to everybody, and they're very dangerous because they're losing the ground, the person's losing the human nature they have to work with, that has an inherent wisdom, an inherent capacity work through, look at, have creative ways of responding, so forth and so on. Is everybody? So how do these happen? And they happen through the process that we've been talking about a lot. I have three different texts here on ways of looking at how this happens from different Buddhist texts. But let's go through real quickly from a real quick, very super quick Buddhist. So the first movement, obviously, is that we've talked about many times. Let's go to the 12 links. In the 12 links, we have liking and disliking. Okay? So the liking or disliking, so we're going through experience, experience, experience. We're having sense experience, sense. And this is not just sense experience with the senses out. It's also the sixth consciousness. So the mind having an experience of a thought of emotion is the sixth sense having an experience. Is everybody... Are we on the same page? So it's not just the five senses of eyes, ears, nose, tongue. There's also the mind, the brain, the mind having sense experiences, which is a sense experience. So whether it be in the first five or the six, it has a sense experience. There's oftentimes a liking or disliking that goes along with that. I like this, I dislike. That's the habit of the past. The liking or the disliking is the karma of the past coming into the present. Now, to work at that level of liking and disliking is really deep, is very deep meditation. So you have to understand that when you're cultivating and meditating whatever for decades and decades and decades, you're still going to be dealing with the history of your liking and disliking from the karmic past forever. Ever past. Okay.
Forever.
For as long as we would know in this room, forever in the sense that the liking or disliking reaction is karma from the past, and you can't get rid of it simply by deciding you're getting rid of it because it's too powerfully habituated. It's not the liking or disliking that's the problem. It's wanting what you like that's the problem. Okay? And it's fearing what you dislike, that's the problem. Or wanting to get away from what you dislike. I dislike it, I want to get away from it, which causes a movement of the mind. Or I want it, which causes a movement of the mind. So the first action is always in, that's the only place we can cultivate, is in the sixth consciousness where the movement from like to want occurs. If we can, through meditation, through bowing, through recitation, through whatever, if we can get in control of our conscious awareness so that when the liking emerges, we let it just simply pass through consciousness and don't go to a wanting with it, the habitual karmic power of that liking disappears thought by thought. It's the only way, you know, thought by thought. Is it, are we clear about the mechanism here? So every time a like, it's not going after attacking the like or the dislike, it's what happens next. And then of course, then if you want something, then the worst thing that can happen is you actually get it. Because then you attach to it, now you're really screwed. What was just a problem has now become a really big problem. I know it's exactly the opposite of what everybody hopes. Everybody wants it, then what they want to get it. But the problem is, of course, every time you get what you want, then now the attachments come in, and now this is beginning to form who you are. So you are the becoming of those attachments. And so then as you attach, now you're limiting, you're in the process of limiting, and you attach. And then, so as you attach, you accumulate your attachments, and that's what's called aging, right? Which many of you have already suffered from in your 20s. I mean, God help you. Okay, so is everybody following? I don't mean to laugh about it. No, I actually do. And every time you accumulate another attachment, you're just aging. You're just dragging yourself down. You're just dragging yourself down into the attachment with completely free open space, and now you're all your attachments, are you out of your mind? Okay, what happened? Okay. So this process that we're describing here, up to that point, but the question is then, in this process, at every step of it, we have the freedom, we have the potential of freedom at every step along. But when the attachments begin to accumulate, then you can begin to see some of them become what we would call more obsessions. Now, in Buddhist literature, there's another way to talk about these obsessions, and that's demonic states, which in fact, whether demonic states and obsessions, they're different. They could be different, but they also are analogous. The first thing, though, I want to look at in here is, we have lots of different texts here, is from the Lankavatara. This is on page... this is on... It says the Lankavatara Sutra, and you have to... And it's on... It's like, what is that? LXXXXIII, and then
133.
Yeah, 133. This is.
Was that? Is L50? Maybe it's 80.
It's 56.
Don't worry about it. Just that's where we are. Okay. Don't worry about your Roman numerals. Okay. So here's one approach. Here's one approach to the process by which. And then it also leads us to an issue that we haven't talked a lot about yet and is in here, and we hopefully will get to it, and that's afflictions. The relationship between afflictions and obsessions. In here we're going to get a really quick, in the Lankavatara Sutra, so the Buddha told, and we're not reading the first paragraph, the second, third, was down in the next one. The Buddha told Mahamadi, the distinguishing characteristics of the five dharmas, the modes of reality, the forms of consciousness, the two kinds of no-self, include name and appearance, projection, correct knowledge, and suchness. That's a lot of Buddhism there. Okay. As practitioners cultivating these and reach the realm of personal realization of Buddha knowledge, they transcend views of eternity and annihilation and existence and non-existence and dwell in the bliss of meditating on what is present and what appears before them. That's what hopefully you're doing.
Where are we?
Sorry. We're in the second. So what you're hopefully doing is you're cultivating the Buddha knowledge. They transcend the views of eternity and annihilation, existence and non-existence, and dwell in the bliss of meditating on the present, which we were just talking about, the eternal present, and what appears before them. Mahamaya, because they are unaware of the five dharmas, the modes of reality, the forms of consciousness, and the two kinds of no-selves are perceptions of their own mind. Because they don't realize these are all perceptions of their own mind. That's the problem, does everybody see? Because they don't realize these are... Fools imagine that their external existence... Imagine their external existence, but not the wise. I mean, why do people give rise to the projections and not the wise? Fools let their thoughts wander among the names and appearances of convention to which they are attached. Okay, stop for a second. People who don't understand their nature, what do? They let their thoughts wander among the names. That's all the names you have in your head for everything. Names, tree, rose. Okay, the names and appearances of convention, which is the normative construct in which we all, quote unquote, exist. Okay. And what's the problem? To which they are attached. So what's the problem? An attachment to, the problem is the attachment to the names and appearances of convention, okay, whose people's thoughts wander, okay? And as they wander among the multitude of the shapes that appear, that's called your head, that's called your mind all day long. Is everybody, are we good so far? The shapes that appear, you're wandering around the shapes that appear, that's called your daily existence. As you wander around the shapes that appear, they fall prey to the views and longings concerning a self. So everything's fine, and even still we're okay, except for that you fall prey to points of view that's yours that are right, and now you're trapped in your point of view, which is obviously always right, because that goes without saying. Your point of view is your worst enemy, because the point of view itself, you're trapped in as the attachment through which you're perceiving everything through already. Your point of view and longings, which is a lot like lackings, but longings even stronger, longings. Aren't you constantly longing for something? Your longings concerning a self, that there's something I'm missing, something I should be doing, something I could get, something I'd be happier doing, something that the self would be more comfortable. Self and what belongs to a self, because remember, that's all those attachments. All the things that belong to the self are all the attachments of the self. And you can think of all those things around you, the people, the places, the things, the cats, the cars. Okay, those are all, okay, and belongs to self, and they become attached to what? Getting more. Excelling. And what do you become attached to? Getting more. It's not even the striving towards getting more, it's being attached to getting more. Not enough. So attached to getting more. And once they are attached, they are blinded by confusion or ignorance and give rise to passion. So passion arises. I've now gone through about 7 steps to passion. You need to read this every morning before you start the day. I can't really convey it all in one reading, but does everybody see? You have the entire step by step, because by the time you get to passion, a lot has occurred. A lot of steps have occurred. A lot of attachments have happened. This all happens in a blink of a thought. This is all habitual now. Every element was created from each moment, but it's now become habitual.
It's a really, really subtle description of desire, kind of that movement of desire. Because I think, in a way, based on my experience and kind of from the studies, that desire, you're attached to getting more because you actually don't get satisfaction from it. It's that anticipation of getting something. So you just keep wanting to get more things to get that, I guess, that reward or something like that, but you never actually get it. It's kind of like buying something. You kind of, that anticipation is more the important thing. So you just keep wanting to
get. And you can see that with everything.
Right.
So every movement has that in it. Are we? And that actually makes everybody a little unhappy too, thinking that, because you have a lot invested in. See, that the thing you have a lot of invested in is the all your projections and justifications of all this time you put into all these stories that you already have going. You have a lot invested in it. And you're not going to give up it very easily. It's not just the things and people, it's the entire investment in a way of looking at things and the way that you feel like you've so far set up and exist. You exist in the habituation of your desire. Not even in the achievement of it or in the objects of projections of it, but in the actual energy of it itself. So it's real subtle, and it's kind of more subtle and more subtle. And that actually comes into every single thing of the day, every single moment. But we haven't gotten very far into this yet. We've only gotten about a third. Okay, we're just going to do this one paragraph here. Okay, so, but you can see sutras are great because one paragraph, you only need like one paragraph of a sutra, and that'll take you your lifetime to, you know, do it. Okay, give rise to passion. And once your passions are inflamed, have any of you had your passions inflamed? Then karma produced by desire, anger, and delusion accumulates. And until this step, you're not having karma. Everything up until this step was all internal process. And it had force and energy and habituation. But until the action gets taken on the basis of it, you haven't created new karma. You have karma from the past and the present, but you're not creating new karma in the future, for the future, right? So they're inflamed in the karma produced by desire, anger, and delusion. And as it accumulates, people become enveloped in their own projections. Are you enveloped in your own projections? Like a silkworm in cocoons or submerged bundle states existence in the sea of birth and death, or as if they were on a water wheel. So a cocoon, so seeing yourself as a silkworm in cocoon, enveloped in your own projections. And everything becomes your own projections. So the whole world and everybody in it is just your projections. And then happiness is getting those projections. If things work according to your projections, you call that happiness. And if things don't work according to your projections, you call that unhappiness. But it's all projections. So it doesn't have anything to do. It's not connected to anything other than the history of this that we're talking about. They do not realize that their own existence is an illusion, a mirage, a reflection of the moon and water, and without a self or what belongs to a self, that is devoid of origination, duration, or cessation. There was never any origination to it. Even the entire karmic past of what comes in the present moment is empty. In the eternal present, all karma is empty. If you were actually able to truly understand your nature, all karma would be empty. So it's devoid of origination, it has no duration, and it has no cessation. Of what characterizes or what is characterized. And it arises from projections of their own mind and not from a creator, time, motes of dust, like quarks and electrons, you know, thingnesses, essential thingnesses, or a supreme being. Thus fools wander among names and appearances. Well, that doesn't relate to us. We're not fools. But people who do the live like this. So that's one process that you can see as that process that we've just laid out there more and more takes over the conscious awareness, it becomes more and more this cocoon in the cocoon thing becomes more what I would call that's the obsessive obsession is the greater and greater amount that that's in control of conscious awareness. That's one description there. We could stop for a second.
Does anybody online have any questions? I think some people might be having some sound problems, so we apologize. But feel free to chime in if you have questions.
Yes.
I have a question about emotion. Earlier we talked about emotion. Maybe we covered that a few weeks ago. Emotion comes with energy, I mean the force. So we mentioned that when we have some emotions, we don't want to grab it if that emotion is good. If that emotion is bad, we don't try to reject that. But how about the force comes with the emotion? I mean, the
well,
that.
See,
that's for hours,
when,
even a few days.
When we say there's a force, or an energy to it, that force or energy is a metaphor.
But you feel it physically.
I know you feel it, but the energy that we're talking about that you're feeling is even metaphoric. And I mean by metaphoric, I mean that certainly you feel what we could call an energy about it, which is the vibration through your body and mind of the thought or the emotion. But the power of that thought or emotion is only has the power of that vibration by the mind giving it that power. It isn't essential. That when we say we got to be very careful because when we say it has a force, we're only using force metaphorically. It doesn't actually have a force. We can say, well, I feel it as a force, but when you say you feel it, for instance, like a sense perception, you feel it as a sense perception. And yes, you could say, I feel the vibration on my ear, or I have the vibration in my eye. And we could say that experience of that vibration is an actual energetic force. But insofar as it has any meaning whatsoever or any actual element of existence, it's all given to it by consciousness. Because even when you say it's having a force in the body, it's your consciousness that's giving it that forcedness nature to it that you're describing. It's not happening as a more essential element of your consciousness. It's simply a description that you're providing for it. It's extremely important not to essentialize anywhere, because any place that you essentialize something as being a force or a karmic, then you've lost the place where conscious awareness actually has freedom and power. Because then it's like the metaphor of force begins to take over as your way your mind has of thinking about it, and then the forcedness of it as a metaphor takes the place of the freedom of mind that actually is there.
Sense of force is also a projection of the mind based on past experience.
Absolutely. But you see, you got to be very careful because every metaphor you pick up starts taking the place of what's actually going on. I'm not disagreeing with your metaphor. It's just make sure you don't essentialize. Does everybody understand what I'm saying? Because what will happen then, you'll start actually thinking something's going on there.
But based on your definition, doesn't that mean that applies to everything? Like desire, like everything, basically? Like any sense objects or any thought has no force?
Yeah. Isn't that kind of the Buddha Dharma?
Doesn't feel like it.
It doesn't have any force. It's empty. When it says empty, what the, it doesn't have any force. It's being created. Even the energy of the motion of it's being created from the mind, not just the object towards which it's projected. It's when the Buddha's saying, he's saying what's empty is even the movement of the mind towards an object of desire, not just that the object of desire is empty. Because once your attention is on the object of desire, you've already essentialized a world, which is just a creation of your mind. Once you get too focused on the object of desire as being the place where the obsession's occurring, you're missing the place where the obsession's occurring. It's not in the object of desire that's occurring. It's in the mind being taken over by an essentializing of something that's actually taking over the free conscious awareness where nothing's going on. Is being taken over by something going on. And the more it's something going on, the more obsessive that something becomes. So wherever we project, that's why, most of these approaches that currently people are taking as the system of reality, well, they're completely lost because there's no, like science, there's no way out at all because it's totally essentialized the world as it actually exists. So there's no, that's slavery to the end. If we go down that road, everyone will be a technological slave in no time because there won't be any purpose for human existence. You'll just be a product. You'll be a producer and consumer of products that will be virtue, that the trade will be digits and computers called money, which are already digits and computers, billions moving from place to place. What are you talking about? So if you take the values of technology and science, human existence will have no purpose or value other than as a consumer, not even as a producer, because it won't be nearly as effective or efficient as machines will be. So if we go that road, human existence will cease to exist. It's just built into it, or it's over, because human existence doesn't even have any place to operate. That's already like in motion, that I'm not even sure. I think only little groups of people will save themselves. I think the whole's gone, but little groups of people won't be able to save themselves. But the whole's already gone because people can't even see the layer upon layer upon layer. They've given away their existence to various theories of whatever. That's way beyond now even thinking about it. I don't even want to go there because it's too boring. Okay, but so
I'm thinking that as soon as we're born, we have a self-image. And as we get older, this image of ourselves, we become obsessed with who we are. Whether we're a bad person, let's say, for example, or a good person. And what I'm thinking you're saying is this projection of who I am, I can get caught up into it so much that I can't get out of it.
Yeah, and so in that sense, most people don't exist. I know it sounds a little extreme, but if we're not talking about what we're talking about here, I'm not sure that there's any existence simply in the story about yourself, your story, and that you're good, and then everything you read into that story that you came from childhood when you were taught to be good, and you're just running in a habit. That's called karma. I think people are misunderstanding. Karma is the construct that's limiting our freedom to the story we're telling that we buy into about good and all this stuff, our cultural construct, our gender. All this stuff is a waste of our time. Everybody's spending all this time on gender. It's a total waste of your time. Who cares one way or another? If you want to get into it, if that's your identity, cool. Who cares? But it doesn't have anything to do with anything at this level that we're talking about here. And every time we buy into any element of that in terms of identity, then it more and more becomes obsessive in that it takes over our entire way of any freedom of place we could operate. And that happens in any place we essentialize, period. There's no good or bad in that. We can essentialize it, but as soon as we've essentialized, then we've already set up the context. And yes, of course, we gathered this very young. We weren't born so much as our early childhood experiences. We had reactions, emotional reactions from very early in our childhood. Those emotional reactions created patterns of response. Those patterns of response became then the ways of adolescence and so forth that we reacted. And I could go back and find probably 4 or 5 experiences that had a huge impact on each of your formation of who you thought you were from experiences you had. The best book that does this is Virginia Woolf's The Waves. If you want to read a book that the best novel that captures what we're talking about is Virginia Woolf's The Waves, where she takes 6 or 8 people from childhood through old age on the immediate emotional experiences with no interpretation. Just one, and she doesn't tell you who it, she's just going, okay, so-and-so, so-and-so felt so-and-so, and then so-and-so felt so-and-so, and they just threw their lives in the flow of their emotional experiences based on those early 2 or 3 experiences that basically formed the entire emotional lifetime of each person, emotional identity and lifetime. This is why, to actually call it, we have to get past culture, past gender, past not just personal identity, but these deeper levels of identity that were kind of so like good and bad person. I mean, it's absurd. Good and bad. As soon as we're locked into that, we think we're, you know, there's no way to cultivate in that mindset. We can chalk up all kind of merit and everyone can think we're really good, and you might even think you're really good too. I just don't know where that goes. I mean, maybe somebody will give you a little medal or something, or when you die, maybe they'll go, oh, she was a good person for a couple of days before they forget us all, right? Sorry for that. I shouldn't have been laughing about that. That's serious business. We don't want to joke about death now, life and death. Oh, no, no. Okay. But yeah, I mean, but realizing the how what we're talking about is so deep. Cultivation has to lead us to a place to understand what we're really trying to look at here and how deep it is, how conscious awareness has to get really back to the ground of emptiness, opening up that realm of infinite and really settling in a space of consciousness that isn't so habituated by all these elements. It takes a lot of practice just to start opening up the space. And then taking that practice into then using that open space in every interaction of the habituation. So you can start using that emptiness to see, oh, whoa, there, oh, wow, oh. And it'll be a totally disappointing existence. I mean, if you actually cultivate, when you try to bring that to your real, to try to bring that level of cultivation to actually being like the way, are you kidding? It's going to be totally unsuccessful all the time. It's going to, because it'll be, your habituation will continue to emerge, and you'll be disappointed at yourself every second for how stupid you are. And you just keep plowing ahead. Or you can fake like you're, or you can do it the way, you know, you can do it the other way, like fake like you're really, okay, that might work too. I don't know, some people are like, oh, I'm really a big guru guy. Okay, you can just, you know, pretend, you know, pretend to be a good person.
Someone had a question?
Yeah, I'd like to ask Bell to elaborate a little bit about the Buddha said that we are in illusion and mirage, like moon and water, and that is arrived from rejection, the projection of their own mind and not from a creator. So what we, in our existence, what happening to us, basically it is an illusion and we are put ourselves here like this?
Yes. It's an illusion and you put yourself here.
I want to be Bill Gates.
It doesn't do you any good. From do you understand from this point of view, what you need to understand is from what we're talking about right now, it does you no good whatsoever to be Bill Gates. In fact, you are screwed. Okay, from what we're talking about now, as I'm around a lot of super rich people, it doesn't do, from what we're talking about here, I can tell you it does them no good at all. In fact, it ties you up more and more because now, how can you give up all this quote unquote comfort and all this wealth and all this? It gets harder and harder. The more wealth you have, the more non-existent you are. To try to be existent and have any wealth is almost impossible. Only people that are a little bit the edge might have a chance. Because being at the edge, you might, out of desperation, you might, out of desperation, take a turn and do something smart. Like, you may, out of desperation, decide, maybe I better really cultivate. So, if you don't have a little bit of edge, I don't think you got any chance whatsoever. I have seen, and I've seen people really try, and it's just the more wealth, the more impossible it is. The more comfortable it is, the more you can. You got to be a little uncomfortable. And you got to be at a little bit of an edge of your body's comfort, or you just settle into that comfort, and there's no space that, and you'll be so settled that there's no space that I'm talking about. You will even emerge in your mind. That's why part of the left on is be a little bit at the edge, even though they're pretty comfortable. Be at the edge. The more that you can be on that edge, but you can actually see the construction of this. But once you bought into it to a certain degree and you buy in, and then it's just too hard to give up the comfort of it. The one thing you don't want to have happen is get what you want. There's two really bad things. If you want something, there's two really bad things that can happen. Anytime you want anything, you can get it or not get it. And not getting it, you can be really upset and sad and feel lost and cry. But at least you didn't get it. If you get it, it'll take you longer to get rid of it than if you didn't get it. So there's only, every desire has only two bad outcomes. Every desire has two bad outcomes. And probably most of the time you were blessed by not getting it. I know it sounds a little counterintuitive, but don't be looking for comfort. Don't be looking to be, that's the last thing you want, Bill Gates. That's the last thing you want to have happen.
I can actually relate to that. After college, I kind of like floated around and made almost no money. And then I got a really high paying job. And for the first time in my life, I could like go into Whole Foods and buy whatever I wanted. Like chocolate, ice cream, you know, like all the things. I could just like fill my cart with all the hippy dippy food. And it was like, at first it was like, oh, this like sensation of fulfilling that desire when you go into the store and you want to get something, but you can't because it's out of your price range or it's whatever. And then it dulled my mind so significantly to just be able to have like that much comfort and not have to like be challenged at all in what is really important to me. It just became like too easy. And I kind of lost what felt like some kind of like creative spontaneity to be able to like actually respond to what my needs were in a more direct way. It's like I could just like buy whatever I wanted. It was
right.
A cop out.
It's exactly, you can see exactly. To be able to buy, money's the worst possible thing, because to be able to buy stuff, the more money you have, the more your relationships are set up around that. The more comfortable you get, the more the comfort's just from this illusory kind of sense that your senses are being rather than just sitting there and dealing with your senses as they are, they're just being dulled by all this stuff. And then the more activity, the bigger the television, the more, then the senses are just being dulled more. So we're in a situation now in the world where we're in an absolute tragedy of human existence. I mean, you could call it the Dharma, but it's a tragedy because every one of these people are of the same nature, have all this exciting, incredible, wonderful nature. Everyone stays the same, even in spite of being totally overwhelmed by their senses. So there's this, like, every person you're looking at is kind of an individual tragedy of kind of being overcome by the allure of all this stuff. And now it's more and more virtual, so they're allured by a virtual reality that's imprinting. So, but we're not gonna, you're not gonna help by joining it. You know, the only chance is a few people hang out and then try to cultivate a little bit and then try to aid and abet when they can. Because if you look at the whole world and how it's going, if everybody was living at that edge, we'd have no problems, no environment. You know, none of the issues would even be the issues they are if people lived at that edge. There's plenty to go around at that play, at that edge. So you can start seeing all the other stuff that emerges that I'm not going to, the economic, political, blah, blah. I'm not even going down all those roads because those are kind of too obvious and, again, boring. Tragic but boring. So you're going to have to do it yourself. Shrivu Maswa said, you know, all the time you say, well, there's a lot of problems. They need to be resolved. Yeah, yeah, so go do it. Who, Shrivu? You. Who else is going to do it? What other bodhisattva? Do you see any other bodhisattva around? I don't see any other bodhisattva. You don't be complaining about other people not taking care of it. You take care of it. Because where other than in your own conscious awareness could you take care of it? You're waiting for someone else to take care of it or something? So, you know, remember, even the solution is a projection from your own conscious awareness. You're still thinking there's something to solve that you could solve without dealing with your own conscious awareness. It's not going to happen. You're just going to become part of the problem. So, yeah. So the other two things in here I'd like people to look at, we're not going to have time to really spend time on, but I always try to give you a lot more than you can deal with just so that people can take it home and read it. Now, the first thing is from the Sharangama Sutra in the chapter before the 50 Skanda demons. And some people here don't know the Sharangama Sutra, but the Sharangama Sutra is a really big, a really cultivating manual. And as a cultivating manual, one of the things it does is it tells you about the kind of states that you could happen when you're deep in meditation or you're actually making progress on no self. So if you're deep in meditation, making progress on no self, going down the path we're talking about here, then he says you have to be very, very careful. And the reason you have to be very, very careful is the less distractions you have in your mind, the more a single distraction can be an obsession. Is there, like right now, most of you are protected from what we're calling demonic states here or obsessive states because you're so distracted by the mundane. I'm sorry, that isn't funny either. But you're so distracted from the mundane that there's no place for, but you could see how if your mind got really empty and still, then a single thought would have a very powerful force and, you know, a vibration force. Is everybody? So, but what the Buddha reminds you in this section is it doesn't matter what's arising of whatever kind, the only way it can take over your conscious awareness is by you giving it the power. There are no forces outside that have, or inside, that have any power over your mind other than what you give them. That doesn't mean they don't have force once you give them. We can see that with love. Once you give somebody, you know, in romantic love, you give that force of it taking over your mind. It clearly does take over. But you had to, at every point, make a decision. And this is critically important. It means that all states, obsession, demonic, or whatever, all have to be let in by the mind. If the mind doesn't let it in, doesn't go towards it, doesn't allow it to take over, it will not. Nothing has power over you from the outside. So he's teaching the solitary stages. You know, we read the purify your mind. Okay, so you can see here, you can read this. This is just the first introduction. You still need instructions, even when you've been doing this incredible practice. He says, if you do not, calming the mind and contemplating insight, but be aware of the last sentence of the last sentence of the first part, but you are still not aware of the subtle demonic events, or we could put it another way, the potential, in Western psychological, we'd say, the potential obsessive thoughts that occur from the unconscious, okay, from the past. But you're still unaware that that occur when you undertake the practice of calming the mind and contemplative insight. If you do not purify your mind, you will not be able to recognize these states as they arise. You will not find the right path, and you will fall into the error of Rambun. Demons arise. May arise when you from the five aggregates or celestial demon ghosts, perhaps a mountain spirit or an animal and so forth. So we go through all these different spirits and stuff that are real interesting. They're in a different frame of reference than our current frame of reference. So in order to understand all of these things we're talking about, you'd have to realize that once you leave the cognitive, rational, sort of empirical construct of reality that you're currently operating in, then there might be a lot of other constructs of reality than the ones you're used to. Okay, and we actually know people that have, you might even know people, I've certainly known a lot of people that have actually come across these, for better or worse, usually for worse. Okay, is everybody, without getting in the 60s, 70s, and 80s, okay, so if your mind is not clear when this happens, when these things come, if your mind's not clear when this happens, you may well take a burglar to be your child, or you may feel satisfied with a small accomplishment. You may have a little bit of clarity, a little bit of understanding, and be satisfied there, and not keep cultivating. Having only reached the level of the fourth dhyana, of course, we're not quite there. But so, and then an earlier practice, it goes through and it describes in just a couple of pages some interesting insights with his commentary on another aspect of demonic stage, which is another aspect of obsession. And then at the end, I gave you from the 100 dharmas, I gave you the list of the 11 wholesome dharmas, the 6 fundamental afflictions, and the 20 derivative afflictions. Because you can see that a major element of talking about that an emotion, one of the things that we can say is usually between emotions and obsessions are afflictions. Does everybody see that afflictions, In a Buddhist cat, afflictions are emotions or actions or thoughts that have taken over the conscious awareness. And an affliction is another way to talk about something that's taken over the conscious awareness and have. So there's a list here. I particularly gave the page on the last 4 afflictions, which is very common to the modern age. Restlessness, distraction, and scatteredness. So I'll let you read those afflictions, because those are, you know, at the heart of modern, a kind of sort of modern the modern mind has a lot of restlessness, distraction, and scatteredness as afflictions. Okay, so you can just read, oh, we won't get to all this stuff, but you can, maybe next week you can look at some of this or some other. Okay, are we? 9:30, it's time to resign.